I hear what John's saying. I agree with him to a certain extent. I just not want to make sure people have an appreciation that this isn't Afghanistan. This isn't Iraq.
Okay, moving on. Anyway.
Cool. Welcome back to Wrong Island. I'm Max.
And I'm Sian.
And I'm Freg.
And we have a really interesting ep for you today. So we're going to be delving into a lot of interesting topics. And we have a special guest. But I guess we wanted to start this discussion by thinking a very strange thought. Scott Morrison, anti-racist activist, defender of Chinese people in Australia. What's going on here? What's brought us to this? So, to delve into this quite odd political moment, we're very honoured to have our good friend Sian Winscript join us. Sian, you want to introduce yourself a little bit? And then we'll get into the discussion.
Okay, thanks for having me, guys. I'm very happy to be here. I'm Sian Winscript. I am a final stage PhD. I feel like I've been saying this for a while. Final stage PhD student at Melbourne University. So I'm writing a thesis on Maoist China, specifically looking at people's private diaries. We have about 800 diaries collected, housed here at Melbourne University. So that's the basis of my thesis. And I'm looking specifically at people's, how they write about their political agency, how they engage with ideology, Maoist socialist ideology. And hopefully I can get it done soon.
We believe in you, Sian.
Thanks. I knew that.
So today is also, it's a special recording for us. One, because it's been a little while between drinks. I think we haven't done an episode in maybe over a month or two. So sorry to our loyal followers. We've just been, nurturing those ideas. But secondly, because I think it's the only time that two Shans have, recorded a podcast
the first
at
the
same
Shans
time
meeting,
in this
which is
studio.
Very exciting.
Right. I've heard a lot about Sian.
Yeah.
Historical moment.
I'm very excited. we are in this bizarre moment where we have Scott Morrison defending one of their members of parliament against the anti-Chinese racism of the Labour Party. So it's reached a little point of ridiculousness, I think, but we did want to talk about anti-China rhetoric, wade through the mud. It's obviously a topic with a lot of history in Australia, but it's having a moment. And Gladys Liu is obviously sort of at the top of that list.
And at the same time, we've got the protests going on in Hong Kong. So we've got these broader geopolitical events occurring simultaneously to this mudslinging in Australia. So let's try and join the dots a bit between some of these different activities.
Yeah.
So we've got this situation with Gladys Liu being attacked by Clive Hamilton. And you're writing a bit about this at the moment with the debate happening there.
Should we just do a little backtrack about who Gladys is for those who haven't been following?
All right. So Gladys Liu, elected as the member for Chisholm in the lower house in the last election, 2019. And Sian, if you want to give a little bit of background for Gladys.
Apart from being a newly elected Liberal MP, I think the thing that people should know about her is that she built her political career on bigotry, mostly anti-gay campaigns, and she Born in Hong Kong. She was born in Hong Kong and she migrated to Australia. She came into politics and her whole political career was built on the so-called, on mobilizing Chinese people in Australia against all these political issues. When her election was actually won predominantly based on her anti-gay campaigns waged through Chinese social media such as WeChat and Weibo.
Do we know when she joined the Liberal Party? Was it like, I think it was in the noughties, but I'm not sure about that. Because for a while she was working like an advisory capacity, I think, to a couple of like Liberal Victorian premiers, but also she was working as like a speech therapist for students in high school. And she's for a long time because of her training, but also because I think she's actually deaf in her left ear, apparently.
Completely deaf. Right.
And I read this on her wiki. Yeah. She was also the president of the Box Hill Chess Club for a while. So she has an interesting resume.
Very versatile.
Yeah. A versatile Loma for her age. Yeah.
a transphobe with tons.
So she's quite a noxious political actor.
Yeah. But she has this title as like the first Chinese-born member of the Australian Parliament, right? Or Chinese woman, perhaps.
I think so, yeah.
So that's the halo they put on her head.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And now her backstory has blown up.
Yep.
Yeah, now she's in trouble.
She is. And now I think they're concerned about her loyalty to Australia. They found out that she has been a member of a supposed CCP organization, the United Front, and they're worried about her political loyalty to this country.
The bigotry was fine, but not the potential loyalty issues.
Yeah. So far, no concentration in mentioning of her politics.
Yeah.
Everything's framed within this sort of loyalty talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so we've got the Labor Party and the ABC and whoever else covering this quite a lot at the moment.
Yeah.
Freaking out that, well, the way that it's being framed is essentially that there's a sort of like an agent of the Chinese Communist Party who's like somehow found this position of power within the Australian Parliament. What does it mean for our democracy? There's, you know, there are real questions going behind that in terms of, well, we know that there are these wings of the Chinese Communist Party and Chinese government that operate through various foundations and organizations internationally and try to drum up sympathy for China through the political loyalty of the diaspora. But at the same time, the way that it's framed in Australia is also, I think, quite dodgy because we're not even really talking about what it is that, Gladys Liu is threatening in the Australian political sphere, or, how she might be, contributing to a sort of, opaque takeover of, Australian politics or country, like on behalf of the Chinese government. So I think it's very busy. It's a very busy issue.
Yeah, there's a lot of innuendo, basically, and there's certainly a distinct racial element to it. But I think that,
how we get to Scott Morrison saying, well, you guys are being racist against our Member of Parliament, which is obviously disingenuous on his part.
Yeah, because Scott Morrison is not an anti-racist offender. But I think that, just to sort of, talk about the background to how we got to this point is that, obviously, there's been this whole idea of members of parliament being disloyal has come into focus with all this big hoo-ha over the Section 44 of the Constitution issue, where we've had a number of MPs over the last few years being expelled for basically being dual citizens or having some sort of claim to citizenship in another country. And it's just been, basically a terrible thing for Australian political life because all these people from the supposed progressive side of politics have taken it upon themselves to use this to attack, like, the Liberals and Conservatives and saying, and to try to get them out by saying, yeah, so, you know, the latest one before Gladys Liu was Josh Frydenberg. Mm. So, yeah, and there's obviously...
On the basis of his mother coming as a refugee.
As a refugee from Hungary. So
during the Holocaust.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, anyway, but people have... So you've got that sort of discourse going on at one side, but then you've obviously got a longer history in Australia of anti-Chinese racism that... has only been ramping up recently with the sort of like new Cold War mentality around sort of people being very afraid of the growing power of China, basically. And these sorts of things coalesced into one with a good friend of the program, Clive Hamilton, who wrote an article saying, you know, basically Gladys Liu is an agent of influence and she should be expelled under Section 44. So...
Even though she's actually... Yeah, she's renounced her Chinese citizenship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not...
She's not a dual citizen.
No, but it's the wording of Section 44 is something about loyalty to a foreign power or a foreign entity.
Is Gladys Liu our Mueller report? You know, is the... Is
like
this situation? Yeah, is this situation our sort of like, you know, Liberal scare campaign? I mean, sorry, smaller Liberal.
Yeah. Well, I think all the Section 44 stuff against the Liberals has been. But, Chan, do you want to tell us a little bit about, I know that you've been writing about Clive Hamilton, and, yeah, what sort of role has he been playing in the last few years in this debate? Who is he?
He's a public intellectual. And he's a professor at one of the universities in Charles Stewart University in Australia. He is one of the main figures behind all these, you know, anti-Chinese fear-mongering campaigns that sort of, you know, got surfaced a little over a year ago. And talking about Clive Hamilton, I think the current issues surrounding, current debate surrounding Gladys Liu and all this, you know, loyalty talk can't be dissociated from him. Mm. He was the man, he was the vocal force for perpetuating this this discourse. Basically, what he's peddling is the idea that, you know, because mainland China is state communism, it's a state, is a communist society country, they can never be trusted, and we need to be aware of their infiltrating our Australian democracy and sovereignty. So that's the basic line of his argument. He wrote a book called Silent Invasion.
Yeah.
It sounds progressive.
Can't remember the...
So he's a supposed lefty,
he's
right?
A very gentle
it's like
title.
Australia Institute. He ran for the Greens in Higgins and writing about overconsumption with affluenza. So he's kind of like...
So he's a maverick.
Soft liberal green sort of thing, and then just mixed in with a bit of kind of hard-edged racist conspiracy theories.
I think the racist conspiracy theories came recently after his... those, you know, small L progressiveness.
Yeah, it's a bit of an Australian tradition, the hard swing to the right.
Right. Anyway, he wrote this book called The Silent Invasion and basically saying that, you know, Beijing's extending its invisible hands towards us, Australia. They're trying to contaminate our democracy, the Chinese students specifically. They are prone to be used by the communist state. He actually used the phrase useful idiots to describe mainland Chinese students based on all these, you know, ideological kind of worries.
But don't you feel like maybe that's how, like, a lot of old white academics or professors walking around Australian campuses and getting sick of all the international students that they're seeing, you know.
That's their attitude as well.
Yeah, like that, but they won't necessarily be saying it, but, you know, it's a brave new world for them and they're resentful and it's sort of bringing out these sort of like you know, little racism monsters that are lurking behind their sort of liberal politics.
Yeah, I think...
Someone told me that the vice-chancellor of a certain large university in Melbourne...
Name names.
...recently was discussing, was asked a question about this at a certain public forum. And and he sort of... I think that his response was, like, quite revealing because he was like, yes, now there is a ratio of one Chinese student to, like, 10 Australian students. And maybe this, you know, ratio is, like, out of whack and, like, maybe we need to, like, rejudge this. But, you know, like anyway.
Maybe you're a ratio. Maybe you're out of whack.
Yeah. Well, I mean, anyway, it shows that, like, as, you know, Ghassan Hajj.
Thanks, Frank.
As Ghassan Hajj, like, famously said about, like, white multiculturalism is that, you know, that's kind of like that white people see themselves in Australia and in Australian institutions as managers of, mm-hmm. like, you know, making sure that the mix is, the mix is right. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so
yeah,
it's an interesting...
About, like, maintaining dominance, yeah. even if you're, like, a pro-multicultural...
Yeah, exactly. Of, yeah. yeah, which is exactly him. He's, like, very multicultural, very, like, anti-racist, supposedly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he's wanting to get the mix right.
Who knows with Clive, but it's just how I... It's just kind of what I imagined. Was he at the ANU for a while?
Was at the Australia Institute and jumping around these different places.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been your take? Sort of seeing some of that increasing over the last few years or that kind of attitude?
Yeah, I think there's Australia's more panics over migrants, especially migrants and students from mainland China has certainly increased. And Clive Hamilton contributed significantly to this fear. But I also want to say that these sort of racialized moral panic has a long historical root in Australia.
Yeah.
You know, nationalism in Australia is always sort of is deeply rooted in this sort of white supremacist racial thinking. And compounded by this is the legacy of the Cold War, which happened recently. Sort of Cold War anti-communist Red Scare is still quite prevalent in our in Australia's national imagination. So these two broad streams converged to produce the current anxieties over the sort of speculated threat of the CCP to Australian democracy, I suppose.
And if we go back even further historically to the 1800s and the start of that early Australian nationalism on the goldfields, you've got the early migration of Chinese people to Australia, and even in some of those maps of the period, San Francisco is called Old Gold Mountain and Melbourne is called New Gold Mountain. So there's this two-stage migration to the US and to Australia. And then in 1860, 1861, during the Lambing Flat riots, there's one of the first uses of the term larrikin, and it's used as a term to describe anti-Chinese rioters going around and injuring people and chopping off their hair and things like that. So this,
like running, like white miners running Chinese miners off the goldfields and beating them very badly, like in modern day Yong, like just a few hours inland from Canberra.
And this all is a kind of lead up of it to the White Australia policy and the immigration restriction act coming in 1901, but it's all the setup for that. So these terms like larrikin, this idea of that's very close to the centre of Australian nationalism is very tied directly to anti-Chinese racism. Mm.
Yeah. A historical yellow peril.
Yeah.
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 True. Yeah, even though Australian industry has actually sought to exploit Chinese labour from the very beginning, has, like, you know, brought, you know, Chinese and other workers in from Asia so that they can, you know, they'll do the work that perhaps there aren't enough people here to be doing or that whites don't want to do or whatever it is and do it at a cheaper rate. But then as soon as, you know, these groups start to develop roots or attain a bit of political or economic power or, you know, start to farm and own their own land, it's like, well, that's enough. Like, out you get. which I think that's actually probably a pretty apt metaphor for what's going on in terms of the education industry here as well at the moment, in a way, but that's probably
a good
conversation.
You see a direct example of that disenfranchisement with the Monash Student Association in Caulfield.
Yes.
Shall we explain that?
All these racialised talks and anxiety deeply rooted in our Australian national imaginary has manifested itself in quite ugly forms recently. I think the latest event is the Monash student election campaigns, where the Monash Caulfield Student Union virtually passed a regulation that bans international students from running the elections. And most of the international students there running the elections are from China, from mainland China. So,
was it based on work hours, like the number of hours?
So, yeah, they changed the motion that they passed was... the motion that they passed changed the work hours or requirement for work hours from 20 hours to 22 hours. So if you're an international student, you can only work in Australia no more than 20 hours per week.
Yeah.
And they increased 2 hours to effectively exclude
It's interesting students. How it's tied to labour like that, that they use that as the mechanism to exclude people. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but obviously it wasn't just like a situation where they arbitrarily decided that, all right, we're just against international students and we don't want them. It was because their ticket was about to win.
Mm.
So it was
last minute.
It was a measure to prevent the Chinese students from taking over.
Yeah.
I'm glad I've never seen any student union corruption in my time.
That's another episode. Horrible. That's our 2003 throwback episode.
So the threat to democracy in this case is coming from the other groups wanting to stop a democratic process playing out and Chinese students being involved.
I think so. It's quite obvious, isn't it, who's threatening, who's playing the role that harms democracy in this country.
Mm.
So the Turnbull government passed legislation. It's called the Foreign Interference Law.
Right.
And basically, it gives gives the government more power to pick who's the spy and who should be.
Give them a bit more scope there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the real threat to democracy is in Canberra.
Yeah.
Bam.
Yeah. I also heard a sort of unsubstantiated story that a few years ago when the Graduate Students Association here, its then leadership was...
Where's here?
Sorry, that was a little arrogant. Just to give the game away, we're recording in a studio on the Melbourne Uni campus right now. Hope that that's not interesting to anybody. but hey, guys, we could book it, so we're good. But the Graduate Students Association at Melbourne Uni was flirting with the university and sort of inviting them in to have more formal power in their governing structures and to take autonomy away from students in the same motion.
Yeah.
And it was sort of like, well, what are these guys doing? They're not actually from the right. And this is sort of, told to me at the pub sort of information, but somebody was like, well, the justification for that was that there was too much influence from international / Chinese students and the Chinese Communist Party within that.
Whoa,
and
that was,
sorry, that, one that, was, that was informing that move to invite the university in to have more power. Luckily, that didn't get up, but that's obviously... a horrible solution to a pretty dubious problem.
But seemingly a quite common one if it's happening in at least two places.
Well, it's like if it's justified to shut down Chinese students' political agency because we have these unresolved fears about the way that China is operating or Chinese Communist Party or government is operating in Australia, then that lets a lot of people off the hook in terms of enacting quite anti-Chinese, politics or decisions at the more immediate level.
Yeah. Speaking of which, I just
I remember there was last month, at Queensland University, there was a gathering of about 100 people. So this event, this demonstration, was organised by domestic students, and it was specifically aimed at Chinese students. And the rally was, the demonstration was basically protecting Australian interests, protecting our democracy. It was a racist demonstration for sure. A lot of, you know, racist things happened on the day. So I guess, you know, speaking from my mind, I think we need to emphasize that we can't fight democracy with racism or bigotry. It's fundamentally hypocritical and incompatible with our ideals. And maybe I'll also end by saying that what actually lies at the heart of all these, you know, talks about China or Chinese influence, like what you said, Sean, is that the mainstream Australia media or government, they are absolutely incapable of imagining mainland Chinese or migrants more broadly as political agents. They're undermining the political agency of the people, especially people from China in the current climate.
So, Sean, at this point we've got these different political forces in Australia, both at the federal level in Canberra and then at the student politics level in Caulfield campus and elsewhere, trying to deny the agency of Chinese students. At the same time, we've got students and other protesters in Hong Kong in conflict with the local Hong Kong government and, by extension, the national Chinese government. And then you've been conducting interviews at the moment with mainland Chinese students in Melbourne and getting their opinions on this, on the situation in Hong Kong. So could you give us a bit of a rundown of what's happening in Hong Kong and then what the students have been saying?
Yep. So in Hong Kong, early this year, the Hong Kong government tried to pass a legislation, they call it extradition bill. Basically, if the bill's passed, the government would be able to send so-called fugitives to places like mainland China. They will be trialed under Chinese state's jurisdiction, and everyone knows that, you know, their system's far from perfect. So people of Hong Kong has been voicing their disagreement with the government against this legislation since early, I think since March, maybe since February, slightly earlier. So there have been protests happening in Hong Kong, originally quite small, but I think around June it became like really big on a mass scale, like millions of people would get on the street to protest against this this extradition bill. Aside from this anti extradition bill sentiment, they're also asking for wider political demands from the government. So they passed five demands or six demands to the government, calling for not only withdrawing this extradition bill, but also, you know, universal suffrage, investigation into police violence, that sort of, you know, concrete materialist demands. So it has evolved into like a mass, like ongoing political movement in Hong Kong.
Are those like evolutions of the demands of the umbrella movement that's been happening in Hong Kong over the past few years as well?
Yeah, so there's an extension from the umbrella movement. Apparently, I think a lot of the unresolved issues left at the umbrella movement got picked up for this one. That's why there's such big level of popular support for the Hong Kong protest from all walks of life.
Was Occupy quite big in Hong Kong as well?
Yeah.
Mm. I was listening to this punk band the other night called David Boring from Hong Kong. They kind of identify as nihilists rather than anything else in particular, but they were talking a lot about how Occupy had informed their politics and also their generation.
Had informed their nihilism.
Yeah, because, well, actually their position was things don't get better, but you just have to carry on anyway and enjoy the music. But anyway, that's another topic.
It's like hedonism.
No, it's nihilism. That's nihilism.
Maybe Gramscian nihilism.
What sort of ramifications? You mentioned the UQ protest, but like, what sort of other ramifications have there been in Australia of the Hong Kong protest?
Right. I want to talk about the Hong Kong protest in Australian context because this is linked to what we've been talking about earlier, anti-Chinese sentiment. So, to me, the Hong Kong protest, this movement, it's not universally progressive, of course. There are conservative voices within the movement.
There's a few Union Jacks waving
around.
Union
Jacks waving, you know.
CIA obviously directing the crowd.
Yes. Stars and Stripes in the
Nostalgia
background.
Nostalgia for colonialism or, you know, racism against mainland Chinese as well within the movement. So there are all these, you know, issues. But fundamentally, I think this is, you know, the movement holds a progressive seat that all lefties around the world should look upon and try to recuperate if we can. But in the context of Australia, the Hong Kong protests have been predominantly used for infuriating or reinforcing anti-Chinese sentiment.
Mm.
The UQ protests, for example, that happened, the racist protest that happened last month, was sort of provoked by this, you know, pro-Hong Kong kind of rally, which happened a little earlier, and there was like a big clash between the pro-Hong Kong camp and the pro-Beijing camp, and all these, you know, media attention sort of put the focus is actually.
And the same happened in Melbourne as well.
The same happened in Melbourne. Yeah. So the media focus is always on supporters of democracy on the one hand, could be Hong Kongers, could be, you know, Australian, and aggressive ultra-nationalist Chinese students on the other hand.
Mm.
So this is the narrative they're weaving. Yeah. And we can see, you know, racist counter rallies being organized in at UQ and elsewhere against Chinese students. Basically, this is, you know, another kind of stereotypical imagination of Chinese students being, you know, foot soldiers of the CCP, ultra-nationalistic, jingoistic. They don't want democracy. They don't support Hong Kong
movement. As one uniform, unthinking body.
Yeah, as a homogenous or uniform, stable body.
So do you kind of see it like a on the one hand, we can see that what's going on in Hong Kong is, even though it's very complicated and there's a lot of different political voices in there, what's being pushed for in terms of political autonomy and democracy, really, it's a worthy movement.
Mm.
But then when the conflict is played out at these sort of smaller scales in, you know, faraway Australia, it's being filtered through a pretty problematic divide.
A post-Cold War lens.
Yeah, in the Australian political context, which is informed by our quite simplistic readings of differences between Chinese students.
Racist.
Yeah.
So it gets meshed.
Racist.
Yeah.
It gets really meshed with our you know, Australian domestic concerns of what's happening, this political climate, I suppose. So to the point that I think it's public discourse on Hong Kong largely missed the point.
Totally. So in your conversations with students that you were talking about before, what have been, you know, some of the things that have come through in those interviews that have either confirmed this or surprised you?
So what prompted me to interview these students was quite simple. It's this, you know, mainstream perception of mainland students as either jingoistic, you know, quite aggressive, nationalistic, or completely uninterested in democratic life.
Yeah.
So either they're In either case, they're portrayed as hostile, disruptive to a healthy democratic environment. So I went around and talk to my old students, or some of them have become my friends. So I asked them, you know, what do you think of Hong Kong? What do you think of CCP government surveillance? So these are the two issues that I asked them to talk about. And contrary to what's been generally assumed, which is, you know, they're probably scared of speaking of these sort of, you know, political sensitive issues, students have been quite chatty with me. They're really engaged. They are open to debate or discussion, and with certain precautions, such as, you know, we need to protect their identity and they need to protect their own privacy. They can be very argumentative, I suppose, politically, not in a, you know, mindless way. Although many of them, of course, constrained by their own history, their own the Chinese situation, they are not quite well informed, but they're very capable of speaking, engaged politically. So their response was quite a surprise, I suppose, to most people that's following following the public media discourse. Solidarity, for example, from these Chinese students with the Hong Kong protesters is actually quite common. Mm. All of them, all the students expressed solidarity with Hong Kong. I mean, these are not, you know, political students. These are just everyday, ordinary students doing undergrad or postgrad here in Australia.
What kind of, like, things were they saying in solidarity with the Hong Kong protesters?
So one of them, for example, when I asked him, what do you think of Hong Kong? He, on the one hand, he expressed his frustrations with the CCP's control over media in mainland China. On the other hand, he says, I support Hong Kong, people of Hong Kong for their democratic movement. Can I read out
these? Yeah, go for it.
So I'm just going to read out part of our conversation or what he's told me. He says, I think those mainlanders who are openly anti-Hong Kong have been manipulated by official media such as the People's Daily, which is a Beijing newspaper, the organ of the CCP. And he says, I and most of my friends and relatives are supportive of Hong Kong, though I personally feel pessimistic about the prospect of them achieving all of their five demands. But isn't it just great that they could stand up and speak out? Millions of people standing together is an expression of the will of the people. If I were a citizen of Hong Kong, I'd go and join them in the street.
Yeah.
You think that's great? Nice.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like what a student would say 50 years ago in China.
Yeah.
About.
Can I read another one? And please. There's another student who's actually been in Australia not that long ago, she came here a year ago. She said something similar, expressed a similar solidarity for Hong Kong, and she also expressed criticism towards the Chinese propaganda state. She says, I think what's happening in Hong Kong is normal. Using nonviolent civil resistance is a normal practice of achieving what people want. What isn't normal is the sense that everything is what isn't normal is the sense that everything is harmonious in China, propagated by the Chinese state. She continues, I understand what the Hong Kong people want and I support them, even if what they ask for is independence. Although I'm sceptical about whether their five demands could really resolve their economic issues, such as the deep inequality and housing crisis, I think what they are demanding are completely reasonable.
So there's a critique of the inequalities in Hong Kong society there
so
as well.
She is actually making an extraordinary link here with the what the progressive forces in Hong Kong are actually critiquing. It's their own economic inequality, you know, capitalist structure. So
absolutely. Yeah.
And these students, you know, they haven't been here for a long time. They're not like long-time Australian residents. So for them to have these views, I think is quite extraordinary. And we should shift our focus from, you know, looking at those lousy nationalist mainland Chinese students to these progressive voices, however fragmentary they are.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Express some kind of solidarity there and extend links and so on, rather than just sort of regarding everyone as this general cutoff kind of amorphous group.
Yeah. So I don't really deny, you know, no one can deny that there are nationalists everywhere in China, in Australia.
In the world, yeah.
In the world. But I think, you know, in this particular political juncture, in this climate in Australia, facing a right-wing government who's peddling these, you know, anti-Chinese sentiment, and also facing the CCP, Chinese CCP authoritarianism, it's important for us to sort of, you know, open this productive political space to engage with Chinese students by listening to them rather than dismissing them as so ultra-nationalists.
And also recognising Chinese students as being very vulnerable and having particular experiences in Australia which other students might not be aware of in many ways. But I was just reading today about Chinese students being particularly targeted in these hoaxes and scams, and they've lost, I'm not sure how much money, or just this year, like over $1 million or something together. It's like, yeah, that Chinese students are receiving these phone calls saying that they might be deported or their visa's cancelled or something unless they go along with pretending that they've been kidnapped and send, you know, these scary photos home so that their parents can be bribed for money. And this has happened to a lot of students, like, which to me suggests that when scary stuff is going on with students here, they're not feeling like they can go and ask for help from people. They're just, they're sort of on their own and
very vulnerable. And don't forget that they're also exploited by, you know, restaurant owners, for example. That's really common.
Absolutely.
Yeah, when I first came here, I got paid. Did I tell you guys?
Yeah, much? I remember this. At a Yum Cha restaurant.
At a Yum Cha restaurant, I got paid like $3 per hour for working at a Yum Cha restaurant.
That's hectic.
$3.
Yeah. So I guess the question is that, like, people might want to know from your, like, doing these interviews, and like you mentioned, it's like a little bit fragmentary. But like, basically, do you think that like the Hong Kong protests, like, they were obviously interested to chat to you about what was going on, but like, is this like having a significant impact, like, on the sorts of conversations that like mainland Chinese students in Australia are having amongst themselves, and like, you know, forming new sorts of political ideas? Or, I mean, is it, maybe it's like, who knows, but like, you want to speculate?
Am I supposed to talk about David Murphy?
Maybe that's a good example,
So I feel like there's been a lot of talk about bringing people together, engaging, politically engaged with Chinese students. But how do we do that? It's a question, right? So how can we engage with mainland Chinese students when they're actually under surveillance?
Yeah.
For sure. There are, we're not to dismiss concerns about CCP surveillance, but we don't want to over-exaggerate. So within this limited circumstance, how can we talk to them or make them talk? I just want to cite a recent example in Sydney, which I think is quite heartening. It's very moving. I think I have permission to cite this. Basically, it's the Sydney academic David Brophy told me about what's happening there. So recently, on campus at Sydney University, I think a couple of days ago, there was a meeting organised by mainland Chinese students with the help of David Brophy and a couple of, you know, Hong Kong students maybe. They came together, held a meeting to discuss and debate issues related to Hong Kong. So the pitch for that event was quite, you know, carefully orchestrated, to avoid, you know, unnecessary attention. They pitched the event, I think, with a focus on fostering mutual understanding. But once people came together, it was actually quite, you know, lively. All the issues were voiced at the meeting. There were presentations in Chinese, and there were, you know, English translations on the screen, and there were Q&A. There was a Q&A in bilingual, in Chinese and English, followed the event. There was, how many people? 50 to 60 people attended the event. Majority of them, of course, was mainland Chinese students, but there was a good contingent of Hong Kong students as well. And needless to say, students from mainland China were quite perfectly capable of expressing their political positions. Sure, there was, you know, nationalism, there was, you know, criticism toward Hong Kong, but there was also support, rational justification and discussion about, you know, other issues and all the, you know, materialist concerns and all that. There were defenses for Hong Kong. So I guess this shows that we shouldn't assume that they are incapable of democratic engagement. Mm-hmm. However limited their view is, we shouldn't assume that. Paying attention to that is maybe one of the first steps that we can do to engage with Chinese students genuinely, mm-hmm. rather than from a top-down perspective.
Yeah.
And also we should speaking from a position of, you know, someone on the left in Australia, I think we should also actively reach out to them to open this sort of, you know, productive political space.
Yep.
And to draw them into this space, you know, people's yeah. mind, even those nationalist students' mind, won't be changed if you ignore them. If you want to change their mind, you should talk to them.
You think there's scope for those kind of events to play out in Melbourne and other cities as well?
I think so. I think we should try to, we should be optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I know a couple of people, including me, we are already talking about how to sort of, you know, replicate that successful event in Sydney here. Mm. We haven't started, but we have started the conversation. So yeah.
That's awesome.
Great.
We were also just discussing prior to the podcast surveillance technologies and their proliferation and, you know, huge political use in China. But also across the world, and the, you know, Australians are under incredible surveillance politically,
yeah.
actually, but in ways that are less obvious to us. But also there are moves to introduce some of the same kind of, for instance, facial recognition technology that's in operation in Chinese cities, in Australian cities. There yeah. are politicians here who've voiced support for that kind of
the New South Wales Transport Minister.
That's right, exactly.
It said it would make it easier for people to get on the train.
Yeah, you could just walk through the barriers because the machine read your face.
Mm. In Victoria, they were talking about uploading everyone's image from your driver's license as well to a database.
From what I read, that is happening. Like,
yeah,
that's going
yeah,
ahead.
That's going ahead.
Yeah, so but we were just saying that it's important for us to actually have solidarity with people in China going through this, not just in terms of, you know, oh, that's something that's happening over there, but that's an international political problem that's becoming bigger for all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in that sense, I think Chinese-Australian, you know, relations of capital and technology are actually scary, not necessarily because, you know, Gladys Liu is sitting in the parliament and has, like, weird friends, but because of the relationships that are going on legitimately, or, you know, supposedly legitimately on much bigger and more threatening scales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gets ignored, right?
Yeah. It's too hard.
We're sort of, we are enlarging this horror that's happening elsewhere, ignoring our own. Mm. So we are exaggerating the, you know, the CCP's influence, but we're ignoring our own government's.
Well, there's a lot of self-congratulation going on about Australian democracy at the moment,
yeah.
despite all these issues happening at the same time, and that as we discussed the main disenfranchisement of students and other groups happening by Australian political actors. I'm particularly concerned about the driving licence photos. My old driving licence, I kind of look like a Al-Qaeda shampoo commercial for this long flowing hair. So.
You're going to be in trouble.
Yeah. I might have a few issues going on.
But I think that's
not your only issue there, Frank. Those YouTube videos.
Yeah,
as well,
there's a bit of stuff going on. Yeah.
But that's particularly where we can, I guess, create those spaces for political solidarity, and where people on the left should, be playing a role in doing that is in precisely saying, Hong Kong students are an inspiration. The whole of Hong Kong society almost is an inspiration for rising up against a repressive government, but not because that China or Hong Kong is especially this instance of authoritarianism, but because these are global systems of control. There's every reason for people, say, in Australia to rise up in the same way and overthrow our government. So are we allowed to
allegedly,
say that?
Allegedly.
Yeah. So we are allowed to say we want to overthrow.
Or at least break a few cameras.
We want to overthrow the government. So that seems the basis on which to, start making those real links of solidarity between Australians, between Chinese students here, between people in Hong Kong,
I think that's a pretty nice resolution to the conversation, and I really enjoyed you being on the pod, Sian.
Come back.
Yeah, that was great.
That was awesome. Thank you so much for having me. Your insight.
And your
research.
Some of these insights will be coming out soon in article form.
I hope so.
Yeah.